This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, Crossover Podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What up, Beck?
What up, Mannix?
Howard, I'm going to keep this podcast civil. I am not going to call you a jackass. I am not. If you decide to tell me that you're going to vote for Julius Randle for MVP, I am going to respect that decision. We are a podcast of inclusion here at Free Thoughts.
I think you've got this whole podcasting thing wrong, Chris. I mean, the way I understand it is you're supposed to have some sort of half-baked opinion. I'm supposed to attack you for it. You're supposed to counterattack, but then I'm supposed to cut you off in the middle of your counterattack, insult you again, and then just kind of gradually or very quickly escalate from there, because that's what the people want to hear, Chris. I think conflict is the way.
Conflict is the way, and if you can do it on an ESPN podcast, even better. Shout out to our friends Tim Bonteps and Brian Windhorst for their spirited debate on a recent pod about.
Hey, admit it. We've both listened to it 5 times by now.
Oh God, yes. I listened to it. I texted Bonteps. I was all over it. I mean, there was like a clip circulating, and I just kept replaying like jackass, 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 jackass. It made my day. Like the amount of text traffic increased by 10% based on how many people were texting that podcast link. All right, a lot we want to get into here. We got to talk about the Celtics, their recent run. I want to talk about something you wrote a little bit about the play-in tournament and how the NBA has handled it. But for our discussion about the Celtics, as we try to bring in smarter minds than our own, we're going to bring in Chris Forsberg. Does a great job covering the Celtics over at NBC Sports Boston. Chris, the Celtics, it was like a month and a half ago where Brad Stevens needed to go take a college job. Danny Ainge should be fired. The Celtics were overrated. Fast forward to now, as we record this, they have won 6 straight. Jason Tatum is playing like an MVP. Robert Williams, when he's been healthy, has been excellent for this team. Start here. What's changed in the last 6, 7, 8 games from what this team was a month or month and a half ago?
Are you trying to sweet talk me by butter me up with Robert Williams compliments before we get going here? Because
Chris, everybody in Boston knows that I was team Robert Williams from the beginning, and you just jumped on my bandwagon.
I have some receipts if we ever have to go down there. I promise not to call you a jackass in that scenario. But you know, it's funny you say that, because I was sitting there and there was a big discussion a month ago in Boston after they lost to that crumble against the Kings. At the finish line, there was talk like, well, should they tank? Should they go look for a lottery pick? Like, who wants to be in the play-in tournament? And Brad Stevens is getting offers from Indiana that, as Woj reported this week, $70 million for 7 years. And it was a weird time in Boston. But, yeah, certainly playing better. I don't know. Like, maybe you guys can help me out here. Should I be optimistic? I'm like, I see things I like from this team, and certainly getting healthier has been probably the most important part of why they've sort of cranked it up a little bit. And Jason Tatum going to another level and taking all the criticism and harnessing it the right way. But I'm still like skeptical. Are they part of that contender conversation at the top of the East?
Yeah, look, I mean, I look at them it's always, you know, it seems reductive to just look at the basic outline. Well, on paper, they've got these two guys and, you know, they've got 2 stars. Other teams have 2 stars. Like, it's not so simple as that. But I look at like the body of work as well as like the totality of their roster. This team made the conference finals last year. I was just looking this up. They actually outscored the Heat by 1 point over that 6-game series, though they lost 4-2. They were really competitive. They don't have Gordon Hayward, but they've added Evan Fournier, who wasn't even part of this current winning streak that we're talking about. As you guys have noted with great delight, Robert Williams seems to be making some sort of leap, hop, something. And so, like I think the requisite talent is there. And Tatum and Brown, we know at their best, is one of the best wing tandems in the NBA. And so, Chris, the thing I'm curious about is this. Like, was it just a matter of, and this is the way I looked at it, and I granted, I'm more charitable than most on these things. When a team that I think is supposed to be good and on paper is good and has proven in the recent past that they've been good, struggles like that, if you look and it's, oh, Kemba Walker's got a knee injury that kept him out for a month and is still getting back, and Marcus Smart is out for a bunch of games and he's, you know, the heart of their defense, and Tatum had COVID. Like, those are reasonable things to point to and think that if all of those things pass, they will be back to the team I thought they would be. Is it just as simple as that?
Somewhat. You know, there was a lot made about how the Celtics have the most days missed because of COVID, and it's pretty pronounced compared. Like, if there's that fan share that's tracking it, and last I looked, they were up to like 140 days. And if you added the bottom 10 teams in the league combined, didn't have that many days missed, and it was still another 20-day drop-off between Boston and next closest, which is like Dallas. So there was something to the idea that they never had continuity and cohesion or had that group out there. I mean, even their injury report, if you look today, when they've got a 6-game winning streak and they're missing half their team, non-COVID illness, and Robert Williams has got a sore knee. So they're still going through it a little bit, but I do think having those guys back, you know, Tatum especially being further out of those COVID woods, though he's admitted that he's still using an inhaler and doesn't quite feel himself. But having the core healthier has probably promoted a little bit better brand of basketball. Mannix, the one thing I remain leery about is when you look at their numbers versus really good opponents. You know, they haven't beaten the Sixers. They haven't beaten the Nets. They've actually gotten blown out by those teams. They struggle against the best teams in the West. Like, is it fair? I guess that's where my pessimism comes from. I just haven't seen it against the teams that they're going to see as early as round two in this postseason.
No, I think that's fair, and I'd like to see them take on those teams with the full deck, right? Like Robert Williams healthy, Smart healthy, Fournier's been out, and he was, as you know, was starting to get kind of his mojo back before he went out of the lineup. I think they, you know, the Celtics, you know, used to say we got plenty of firepower. And then they go out and sign Jabari Parker. Like, and then they play Jabari Parker. Like, it's like, you know.
They play Jabari Parker in crunch time.
Yeah. he played, I remember he was tweeting about it at the time, but like he scored more points in one game with the Celtics than he did all season in Sacramento. So I do worry about, you know, the offensive punch that they're going to have come playoff time. But I do think that the development of Robert Williams, what Smart brings to the table defensively and energy-wise, plus, you know, what they can get from Fournier. Fournier, to me, Chris, is like the ultimate wild card. Like, there wasn't a lot of fanfare in Fournier coming to Boston. In fact, it was more about, well, they got Fournier, but they didn't get Aaron Gordon. So they didn't really make the kind of big deal that the Celtics needed to. But Fournier is a 20-point-per-game scorer. We saw in that game against Houston where he hit 6 3-pointers in the fourth quarter, the guy can shoot it. So I think if he comes back and looks like the Evan Fournier we've seen in Orlando, that to me is the potential difference maker that I'm still not sure how is going to fit in.
Yeah, I think we all know what their top five is capable of, right? That core four of Kemba, Jalen, Jason, Marcus, and then whoever plays the center position. Like, they've done well with Tristan when he's in there, but Robert Williams certainly adds a different dimension. The bench has been the issue. And I think, you know, when you watch this team early in the year, no offense to Semi Ojeleye and Grant Williams, but not the most consistent players this year. Grant kind of took a step back from the bubble and they were playing a lot of minutes at times in that postseason. So early in the season. So now they've got a guy like Fournier, they've got Romeo Langford back healthy. The bench just looks a lot different. And I do think that they need,
shout out Romeo Langford, baby. Romeo, like, where have you been, Romeo, all this time? like there was like, and I don't know if, I'm sure Chris, you probably saw us. I don't know if you saw the Twitter thread of like, there was some theory that Romeo Langford was actually dead and like he didn't actually exist, that, you know, people were just making him up. But Romeo Langford comes back. I was hearing Forsberg about, you know, Langford and like practices, like the guy can finish at the rim. He's got some talent. Now let's see if he can give you something in the postseason.
And that's
why if I were going to invent an NBA player out of thin air, I would name him Romeo Langford. in defense of those people, that is the right name to pick for a manufactured fictional player.
like an NBA 2K player creation that you put on the playground and be awesome. No, you know, like Romeo, they tried to go to Romeo in the Eastern Conference Finals last year before and he was already playing with like the torn ligaments in his thumb and then he hurt his groin. You know, look, he's got to stay healthy. I mean, that's the main thing. That's why everyone thinks he's fictional. But he does have an amazing wingspan and can stay in front of people and just gives you that sort of versatile defender that everybody sort of needs on that second unit in the playoffs. I don't know if he's what he's still their eighth or ninth guy, but better than what they had trotting out at that point. So again, I see all these pieces and I say, if it all comes together, if it all works, there's a chance for them to be a contender, but I just still think there's a lot of ifs and, you know, ultimate amongst them is just Tatum and Brown continuing to want to go to another level. And we've seen Jason Tatum be really good and harness that criticism in recent weeks, but there's still another level for him to get to. They still, the one thing I come back to, Howard, is like they need to figure out how to make each other better when they're out on the court, you know, whether that's setting each other up or making the players around them better. I think that's just the next step for a young player. Then now they're already established themselves. How do they get it so that the team sort of everybody else becomes better because of their eliteness?
Now, Howard, do you want to know the mortal lock for next season? Is what players are eligible for extensions after 3 years. Like Romeo Langford is going to play 75 games next year and average like 18. Like that is like a lock. Like that. So go ahead. But that's a lock.
No, but what Forsberg was saying about Tatum and Brown and the way that they work together and elevating each other and feeding each other, I would throw Kemba into that conversation too, because that kind of comes and goes with him. But like that, especially for Tatum and Brown, Kemba's a little bit older veteran at this point, but for young guys who are elite offensive players and elite creators in this league, like that is the evolution that they all have to undergo. That's, you know, that's the story for almost every good young team that has, you know, high level talent that's trying to figure out how best to leverage their talent, not just for themselves, but for their team. Like that's, so we're going to see ups and downs. So like, I don't think any of that should be surprising. Chris, I think one of my curiosities is this. I feel like when the Celtics stumble, or when they have the kind of, you know, season that they're having, this jagged season, and all of a sudden now it's about what Danny Ainge didn't do, what Brad Stevens isn't doing, I feel like it's often about the whole, you know, other like Twitter, you know, NBA Twitter narrative of all the moves that are not made. And so now if things are fine, we just kind of push that to the back burner. But if they're struggling, then it's, well, why didn't they go out and get Miles Turner? You know, why didn't they use the full trade exception from Gordon Hayward?
Yeah, they should have gotten Miles Turner. That's just me chiming in.
So, Chris Forsberg, why didn't they get Miles Turner? This is where I was leading.
So the Miles Turner thing was just, they didn't want him. Like Danny Ainge went to his players and said.
Insane.
I'm just saying.
Should they have?
I don't know if they wanted to pay a center $18 million for the foreseeable future.
That's like the mid-level exception nowadays. Like Kelly Olynyk's going to get $18 million next year.
He would have been biting into the Time Lord's time. They might never have developed here. I don't know if it's the right decision. I think they liked what Tristan Thompson could bring in terms of experience, in terms of the guys on that team wanted to play with him. And I just think they were leery. Like, look, the core four played with Miles Turner in Team USA. And I'm sure Danny Ainge was like, hey, we have a chance to go get this guy. Do you want to get him? And if they were lukewarm about it, then maybe they said, hey, at half the cost, we can get Tristan Thompson for 2 years and still develop our young center and figure it out further down the road. So I just, you know, you can always second guess every move. What should they have done? And look, if they don't resign Evan Fournier in this offseason, or if they don't at least sign and trade and get something back, heaven help us if it's another traded player exception, because I cannot go through 365 more days of TPE talk. But if they get nothing out of that, then yeah, look, it's fair to criticize. They need players. They need bodies. Like, you can't scoff at a Doug McDermott when your bench can barely hit a three-pointer. So I just think the jury remains out on that one, depending on how Fournier does and what happens long-term with him. But yeah, certainly I think Danny would be the first to admit he didn't put together the right roster. I think Brad's had some bad moments this year, not trying to like being able to catch his team and get them to respond to adversity, but they're turning a little bit of a corner now. So let's see where it goes. But everybody bears responsibility for why this thing hasn't been as crisp as it should have been to this point.
Okay, the jury is not out on that trade. The jury has given its verdict on that deal. You should have, like, I get, all right, fine. Like Smart, Walker, all those guys they played with Miles Turner at Team USA. I don't know what they said or how they said it, if they, whatever they said, if anything at all. But Meanwhile, I'm going to be putting Miles Turner like at the bottom of my defensive player of the year ballot, and $18 million, you have to pay Evan Fournier that probably to keep him around, you know, beyond this season. You know, somebody, Chris, is going to be crazy enough to throw money at Evan Fournier in the offseason. I just like Miles Turner. See, this is why I can't argue that I'm a bigger fan of Robert Williams than you are, because you just said Miles Turner might cut into Time Lord's minutes, which is... You know, which is crazy now.
Not
which
is who is the crazy more, who is the more impactful positive player?
Okay, no, you're now probably Robert Williams. But 6 months ago, when this was all happening, it was Miles Turner. Like Miles Turner was the better player than Robert Williams back then. We can't dispute that.
Danny Ainge had the foresight, like a Time Lord, to know that if he gave him a valuable time, that's why he like held out. That's why, you know, like all right, maybe Danny didn't know for sure at that point, but at least he figured it out by the deadline, and that's why they moved Daniel Tice and figured out that they needed to play this guy.
They moved Daniel Tice because they didn't want to pay the luxury tax. Like,
well, know. And so hold on. Well, you can't make that case then, because if you would sign Miles Turner, you were going into the luxury tax.
Well, good. Like, you know, I want it's not my money. I want to pay, you know, spend. Let's go. Way. Go get Miles Turner. Kelly, Doug McDermott, by the way, that team could use Doug McDermott. Brad Stevens would have found a use for Doug McDermott for sure. In that rotation, 100%. Let me finish with this, Chris. The stakes for Boston this year. Like, if they wind up getting beat by Philadelphia in the second round, does that mean anything? Do you think there'll be a reaction from this team if they get beat early?
Is Bradley Beal available this offseason?
No, Bradley Beal, merry-go-round. I can't.
All right, so I don't know. You know, but that's the big question, right? Like, if this core just can never get over.
Boston will offer Romeo Langford and 2 firsts for Bradley Beal. That's good. That's what happened with the Harrison Barnes stuff. The reason Harrison Barnes is not a Celtic because the offers were painfully low for Harrison Barnes.
And the fact that, I mean, Sacramento was just really, really hoping they would get that playoff berth. How'd that work out?
Not so well.
They're not out
we
yet.
All knew that the Celtics were going to get the Sacramento Kings were going to get to send Boston a 4-man that would swing this season. And that was evidently Jabari Parker instead of Harrison Barnes. All right, look, if it doesn't work, again, if say they get second round, say they get to the Eastern Conference Finals, but they don't get over that hump. There's a tough discussion about, like, where is this team going? Okay, like, is Tatum and Brown and whatever this core enough, you know, and Kemba, we didn't really spend a whole lot of time on it. He's playing better now, but there is long-term questions about, is he the ideal fit? He's upped his playmaking in recent weeks. Can he continue to buy into that and be a productive player now into his 30s? And so there's some question marks moving forward, but you know, if Tatum and Brown continue to develop, they're still on the right path. But I do think there's, if a Bradley Beal comes available, there's tough conversations to have. And this team does have to at least pay mind to who is the focal point? Is it Tatum?
Wait, who do you think we're trading? Who do you think Boston's trading for Bradley Beal here? Like, is it Tatum or Brown?
Jalen Pick. Like, and I hate look, and I'm gonna get hate back here because of this, because I don't like throwing Jalen Brown into trades. I think he's like, there's no reason to believe he will ever stop moving forward because of the way he's just so motivated to continue improving his game. But if you're just not able to get to where you want to go with what you've got, you do have to start to think, okay, like, what's going to make sure Jason Tatum wants to be here long term? Like, is there a better fit next to him? And I don't know.
The guy did just sign like a 5-year extension. I don't think he's got much of a choice at this point.
I'm just saying, but the league comes at you fast. Like,
yeah, it does.
You know, and so I just think those are his good buddy
Bradley Beal next to him. You know, they can be, you know, they're so excited to play together, an all-star. They can play together once again.
If pursuing Bradley Beal guarantees that you have Jason Tatum for the duration of, or whatever, you know, long of his prime, then you have to think about it. I'm just saying that's the sort of conversations they have to have if they continue to fall a little bit short of expectation. But
would you trade Jalen Brown for Bradley Beal straight up?
Ooh.
Beck, I'll ask you next.
I might.
Yeah. See, this is the conundrum.
Pause. Yeah. And would Washington?
This is the thing. I don't think the Wizards would say, I want a first. Howard, what will you do? You're the neutral observer here, Howard. We're both Boston guys, so we. Yeah.
I don't know that I would trade Jalen Brown for Bradley Beal. Younger, bigger, still evolving, still growing, better defender, clearly. I don't know that I'd want to give up on the promise of what Jalen Brown and Jason Tatum can be long-term next to each other. As gifted of a scorer as Bradley Beal is, as great of a ball handler as he is, he's become a really great playmaker. I don't know that that's the best long-term play. And yeah, the Wizards might charge you more than that. They might ask for Jaylen Brown and some picks or something. And at that point, I really don't want to go that far down that road. I'm not sure that...
And Danny Ainge is going to ask for like a pick. He'll be like, all right, we'll give you Jaylen Brown, but give us Bradley Beal and a future first.
He won't put Robert Williams in the deal. And that'll be this thing we come back to. They'll be like, they could have got that deal done, but they want to give up Robert Williams. And then I'll be like, oh, that makes perfect sense. So I will say this, because just to hedge my bet here, when I listen to Jaylen Brown and the way he handles the responsibility of leadership in Boston, the way he spoke out on topics outside of the realm of basketball, I would also be very hesitant to trade him, because I think, especially as Jason learns to be that superstar and embraces that role a little bit more, like Brown takes that on immediately. He wants to deal with the hard topics, I would say. And so I do think there's value in that too. And I don't know, like, you know, part of the reason I always sit there and look at the Wizards and sometimes say, Bradley Beal is so good, why aren't they winning? And then I see that roster and I say, okay, it makes a little bit of sense. But yeah, I don't know if having to give up more than just Jaylen Brown makes you a better team. That'd be, but those are tough decisions. That's why Danny Ainge gets paid a lot of money.
Yeah, I don't think that that trade's going to happen one way or the other. Chris, we appreciate it, man. Thanks for joining us here.
Thank you, guys.
All right, Howard, I want to talk about the big news that broke last week. LaMarcus Aldridge, the 7-time All-Star, 5-time All-NBA forward, he announced his retirement because of a heart irregularity. He felt something in his last game against the Lakers. Aldridge, if you follow the course of his career, has had some heart-related issues before. He hasn't spoken publicly about it, but I would imagine this was probably just the last one that he wanted to deal with. So we'll get to the ramifications on the Nets another time, but LaMarcus Aldridge, the player, do you see him as a Hall of Famer? I mean, I gave a couple of his credentials there, 7-time All-Star, 5-time All-NBA. He scored very nearly 20,000 points. I think it's 19,950. He was probably like 40-something away from getting there. He's got some good statistics. Some good longevity in this league. Do you see Aldridge as a Hall of Famer?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, obviously, you know, thoughts with LaMarcus Aldridge. Hopefully, whatever the heart issues were is something that settles down as a non-NBA athlete, right? Like, you can have heart issues that are not life-threatening if you're not pushing the envelope. And so hopefully whatever it is settles down and he's you know, has a great, long, healthy retirement and wish him the best. He had a really, really, really nice career, right? Like, which sounds like the run-up to saying somebody's not a Hall of Famer, which is what I'm going to say. 7-time All-Star, 5-time All-NBA. Like, if that's the outline, it sounds like you've got the requisite credentials, right? That was 2 seconds and 3/3 on All-NBA, right? He was never first team All-NBA. And that's not necessarily the be-all, end-all on how to judge a Hall of Famer. But career averages of 19 points, not quite to 20, 8 rebounds, not quite to 10, 1.1 blocks. He finishes 62nd all-time in rebounds and 51st all-time in points scored. So he was a really good player who had a long enough career that he climbed those leaderboards. And as you point out, you know, just shy of 20,000 points, which has often been a bar for entry for the Hall of Fame. Basketball Reference has an algorithm of some sort that estimates your Hall of Fame probability based on the guys who are already in. And for LaMarcus Aldridge, it's 51%. Like, he's right there at basically 50-50 for the Hall of Fame, which is why this debate will go on for some time, I suspect. I just think that, Chris, there's nothing to round out his resume. It's the Basketball Hall of Fame, not the NBA Hall of Fame. So if your NBA stats were really solid, but not dominant, not spectacular, not mind-blowing, and his are not, well, you could still get in if you won a gold medal. He was never on the Olympics. You could still get in if you had some, like, really historic tournament run in the NCAA. He did not. He played in one NCAA tournament game. His postseason in the NBA was okay. He made the second round once in Portland, where he played with Brandon Roy and then Damian Lillard. He made the conference finals once with the Spurs on a team anchored by Kawhi Leonard, and they had one other year where they made the second round. There's no memorable moment or or game, at least to my immediate recollection, that says this is what LaMarcus Aldridge was all about. This is what defines him. This is why he's better than just his stats. I hate to use the word narrative in this case, but the larger narrative that tells us why LaMarcus Aldridge elevates to the point of Hall of Fame. I just think he was a really, really good player in the course of a pretty long career, who was part of some good but not great teams, and who did not make enough of a dent in that time, I think, to certify him for the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're going to be discussing LaMarcus Aldridge for, you know, the next few years as that borderline case. If Chris Webber gets in this year, I think Aldridge takes his place as that guy where we're wondering, was he worthy of the Hall of Fame? Because Aldridge's, his total stats were stronger than Webber's. Certainly not the impact player Webber was. And I think that works against Aldridge too. There was a time when you could certainly argue Webber was top three at his position in the NBA for a few years. Aldridge, I don't think, was ever really that guy during his career. But what works against him, and you touched on this, is the playoff resume. He's got playoff games on that resume, but not impactful playoff performances and not teams that went deep into the playoffs. Now, some of that is circumstance. I would have loved to have known what LaMarcus Aldridge's resume would look like if Kawhi Leonard doesn't get hurt in, 2017? And if Kawhi stays in San Antonio beyond that, that might have been a game changer for LaMarcus Aldridge. It would have given him the opportunity to play deep into the playoffs. But as it is, he doesn't have that deep playoff resume. I think having to retire now actually works against him when his Hall of Fame case gets made, because he wasn't going to be a star on this Nets team. But based on what we saw in the last couple of months or a couple of weeks or whatever it was since he signed there, he was going to play a role with that team as the starting center with that team. So if the Nets were to go on and win a championship and Aldridge was going to play a role on that team, I think that would have helped his Hall of Fame candidacy. And without it, I just think he's going to be that guy. He is going to inherit the role of that guy that becomes the bar. Like, if you're better than LaMarcus Aldridge, you get in. If you're not as good as LaMarcus Aldridge, there's no chance you get in.
Thus the 50%, 51% chance of making it, according to Basketball References algorithm.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, you hate to say that for a guy who's at the end of his career, who was not going to necessarily statistically do anything else to solidify his case, you hate to say that he falls short of the Hall of Fame by maybe a couple months of play and making the finals with the Nets. But that really might be what it comes down to. Because as I noted, there's no one signature playoff run or moment that says this guy is more than just those stats. There's nothing else to elevate him beyond his stats that are good but not spectacular, right?
Let me ask you this out. What's the difference between LaMarcus Aldridge and Chris Bosh?
So, obviously, the biggest difference is Chris Bosh goes to Miami and wins a couple championships and goes to four straight finals with Wade and LeBron, right? If he stays in Toronto, the championships never happen. And so you could say that Bosh was simply the beneficiary of going to the right place at the right time, right? I would say, though, that Bosh was the clear, absolute centerpiece and foundation of those Raptors teams. And I think played at a higher level than LaMarcus Aldridge overall, if you go peak to peak. I mean, you brought up Chris Webber. We'll see if he gets in this year. But, like, Webber's peak was higher than LaMarcus Aldridge's peak. Webber was also a playmaker. Webber was also just a much more dynamic scorer and was the most important player of a Sacramento Kings team that, LaMarcus Aldridge made one conference finals with the Spurs. Chris Webber made one conference finals. But Webber's conference finals were a product of Chris Webber's talent in large part. And that team won 61 games and was within, a breath of knocking out the Lakers in the year of the Laker three-peat. You know, and that's an all-time team, too. You know, they're that close to knocking out the Shaq and Kobe Lakers in year three of a three-peat. So Chris Webber's peak and his overall impact is higher. And, I like the definition of Hall of Fame that's this, that when in doubt, if you're not sure whether the other resume items like stats and Hall and all NBA and all that, if you're not sure if all those are there, and you're still asking the question, is he a Hall of Famer? Ask yourself, can you tell the story of this era of the NBA without this player? And in Chris Webber's case, you cannot. Those Kings teams were really important. They were influential. They were exciting. And they made an impact. LaMarcus Aldridge's career, I'm sorry, falls short of that standard.
All right, let's move on and talk about something you wrote about earlier this week, and that is the state of the play-in tournament. Obviously, the Dallas Mavericks are the loudest opponents of this year's play-in tournament. Luka Doncic made the point of, well, we're playing 72 games to get into the playoffs. Why do we need to play a few more? Mark Cuban, talking to ESPN, said it was a mistake to have created this play-in tournament. Do you look at this, Howard, as being a team that is in the play-in tournament mix and doesn't want to be, has a problem with it, or is there merit to, you know, this argument that you've got 72 games this season, 82 games normally to settle the 18 playoff field? What do you need a play-in tournament for?
Yeah, and I get that, and I'm somewhat sympathetic to it. But look, the NBA created the play-in tournament for multiple reasons, not least of which is hopefully as an inducement to get teams to keep competing down the stretch of a season, an anti-tanking measure on some level. And in that regard, it's working. So here we are. We are, you know, down to, what, 15, 16 games for most teams left in a shortened 72-game season. There are six teams that are definitely out, three in each conference. And there are other teams that are still competing that wouldn't be in a normal year. So in the West, Oklahoma, Minnesota, and Houston, they're out. The Pelicans and the Kings, in a normal year, we'd be writing them off and saying they're out too. But because you only have to get to 10th to at least make the play-in, they're still incentivized to compete. I think that matters. In the East, Cleveland, Detroit, Orlando, they're out. But Toronto, Chicago, and Washington are still in it and competing to try to be in the play-in. And again, in a normal year without the play-in, those teams are folding the tents. So that's five fan bases, five teams that are still engaged. That's healthy for the league. Now, if you're the Mavericks sitting in seventh, you think, well, that's not good for us because one hiccup in the play-in tournament and we could be out. And so for folks who don't know how this was going to work, seven plays eight, the winner gets the seventh seed. The loser of 7-8 plays the winner of 9-10, and that team gets the eighth seed. So you if you're the seventh or eighth seed, if you finish seventh or eighth in the regular season, two losses and you're out. 9 or 10, one loss and you're out. So I get it. The Mavericks are in a really precarious position. But one, they're still close enough to sixth that they can go get sixth. So Mavericks, if you're worried about finishing seventh and it's unfair, great. Go get sixth. I hate to sound harsh about it, but it's within reach. If you don't like what happens at the seventh spot now, then go finish sixth. It's in your control. Also, I understand, like, the reason they're in a precarious spot is because they have been affected almost more than any other team in the NBA by COVID. January was a disaster for them. It was tough. They've been trying to make up for it ever since, and they have. They've done really well. They've rebounded really nicely and should be proud of that. But that's one of the reasons why it's appropriate this year to have the play-in as a buffer, because other teams, I mean, Toronto, Miami, you know, teams that we knew were really good last year, perennial playoff teams, look at where they are. Miami's farther down in the standings than they should be. Toronto is on the edge of you know, playoff slash play-in. Other teams have been affected too. In fact, most of the league has been impacted on some level, all to varying degrees, of course. But that's why it's nice to actually have a little bit more of a safety net in this season in particular, because it's been such a strange and screwy year.
Yeah, I think long-term, the play-in tournament needs to be tweaked. I think you don't need to have 7 and 10 involved. I have no issue with 8 and 9 being interconnected with some kind of play-in game. I would like to see it be a situation where the number 9 seed has to be within one or two games to have the opportunity to make the playoffs. I don't want to see a scenario unfold where the 8 seed has to play the 9 seed and the 9 seed is like 6 games out of the playoff picture. I'd like to see it be a competitive race. They just add kind of one more game to it to settle the differences. You disagree on that? You could say take a deep breath there.
I've got two questions. All right, so one is this. Let's use Miami as the example. Let's say that Miami, in your scenario, it goes nine deep, and Miami is this Miami team, but they've lost Jimmy Butler for the first half of the season. They spend the whole second half scrambling to make up for lost time once he's healthy and they're whole again. And they finish five games behind eighth, right? But you know they're actually, on talent, a top four type team. Under the old system of just eight, they're out entirely. Under your system, they've still got to be close enough to get in. And I would just say that sometimes a team that's finishing that low in the standings, it's because there was misfortune early in the season, mid part of the season, but they might actually be a better team and make for a better, more competitive first round matchup against the top seed because they're peaking at the right time. They got healthy at the right time. Sometimes these teams are crossing in the night, right? You might be the eighth seed on a downward slope and the ninth seed might be on an upward slope because of when they got healthy. So there's that twist that I would throw in. And then the other part is
let me answer that first. Like, the way I would answer that is, I mean, honestly, like, tough shit. Like, you know, you don't, I mean, look, it's an 82 or in this case,
well, that's
72.
What I say to the Mavericks, tough shit.
Well, yeah, I mean, then that's a fair argument. Like but is it 72 game season? Like if, you know, injuries happen and they suck and, you know, I hate seeing what happened to Jamal Murray, you know, what's been happening to Kevin Durant, but it's part of the game. I don't think that, I mean, I think the teams that, and some of it look is whether it's, you know, load management or, you know, how teams approach practices, like there's a method to the madness of keeping guys healthy at times with these teams. So I think if a team goes an entire season, 72 games, and, you know, is five games up on the number nine seed, I don't think they should have the misfortune of having to play a completely healthy, loaded team that ordinarily wouldn't be in that position. I think they should be rewarded with the eight seed, even if that eight seed means you get your clock cleaned in the first round. Because as you know, Howard, like there's real value to that sometimes. Like, I mean, for young teams coming up, even if they get smoked, like getting those four or five games of playoff experience, you know, that is a building block that you can use to better yourself in the next season and beyond.
Yeah, teams would like to think so anyway. I don't know that we could prove that, but yes, that is kind of the sentiment around the NBA.
Yeah, but like you say you didn't prove that, but like remember when Oklahoma City got to the playoffs against the Lakers? Were you covering the Lakers back then when this was like 10 years ago, 11 years ago? 2010 maybe, I want to say.
11?
I think it was 10. Yeah, I think it was 10. When they were the 8th seed. But like you and I've talked to Scott Brooks about this a lot. Like you're not going to convince me that wasn't, you know, going through with the Lakers didn't make the Thunder, who 2 years later were a finals team.
Yeah, no, it's fair, and I think most of the time it is it's a legit thing. There is something to growth. There is something to playing against an elite team, especially if you're the eighth seed. By definition, you're playing a one seed that probably is going to have some of the best players in the league on it, and so getting to play in high pressure games in that spotlight against them can be helpful. Plus, it's, you know, you're selling tickets. You've got at least two home games, so it's good for the bottom line of the team. It's good for that fan base. It's good for belief. It's good for, you know, showing whether it's your fans or free agents, we're a team on the way up. You should want to be on board. So I get that. But when it's the Mavericks or anybody else, you know, griping about the unfairness of this system, I would just say this. You're really griping about the getting the right to get smoked in the first round. It's like, it's not some great honor to be seventh or eighth. Like, I understand you want it, but
you think that's true this year? You think that's true this year? Like 7-seed Dallas against 2-seed Phoenix. Like, you think they get smoked?
Last year we were saying that the Trailblazers were going to be the toughest 8th seed in the history of basketball, and they got smoked anyway. let me just go through the stats before we talk about this year's Mavericks. Since 1984, when they went to this current format, the 7th and 8th seeds have the same record in the first round, 5-68 overall in the series. So that's 10 upsets in 146 series over 36 years. But it's less frequent than that since 2003, when the NBA went to the best of 7. So it used to be best of 5. So when people say, oh, but the Knicks as the 8th seed go to the finals back in 99, not only a lockout year, but that was a best of 5 first round. Easier to pull an upset in a best of 5 than a best of 7. So since the best of 7 was installed in 2003, one 7th seed has pulled an upset, and that was the Spurs over the Mavericks in 2010. There have been 3 upsets by the 8th seed since they went to best of 7. Warriors, that's the We Believe team, over the Mavericks in 2007. Mavericks are often on the wrong end of these things. The Grizzlies over the Spurs in 2011. And the Sixers over the Bulls in 2012. And that's got a big fat asterisk because Derrick Rose goes down in game one with his infamous ACL injury that changed the entire course of his career. So it just doesn't happen that often. The seventh and eighth seeds, this is the problem. Like, there's no suspense in the NBA in the first round. You know, is a five going to upset a four? I'm putting upset in quote marks. Possibly. Six over three happens sometimes. Sevens and eights beating ones and twos almost never happens. And so what are we really arguing about with the fairness of the play-in? You're like, the difference between the seventh place team and the 10th place team might be big in the standings, but it's not big when it compares when you're comparing it to how they might fare against the one or two seed. Because they're going to have the same fate. They're going to get knocked out.
Yeah, I'm saving this tape when the Mavericks knock off the Suns first round. You're going to eat those comments there, Beck. That's for sure.
I might. And Mark Cuban will be sending me all caps emails.
100%. I want to get to a couple of questions from social media, but I do want to ask you first. We got to touch on Steph Curry and what Steph's done this year. I mean, 10 straight games of 30-plus points, you know, in the MVP conversation. I respect to Magic Johnson. I don't think he's, you know, guaranteed to win by any stretch. Thank you for that, you know, Twitter vomit recently, Magic. That was that was a lot of fun to read. But it, you know, it tells you something, right, about Steph Curry. I mean, I'll let you go first, but I mean, I've learned something about Steph Curry this year. What have you learned about Steph?
I don't think it's necessarily what I learned, but I'm glad to see him do it just because, like, I'm somebody who always believed in Steph Curry's ability to play at the highest level, whether it was with Klay and Draymond next to him and the strength in numbers Warriors, or whether it was with Kevin Durant. I think that there are people out there, I am not one of them, to be clear. There are people out there who have often been skeptical to critical of his career, saying, well, you know, you beat, first of all, because he wasn't Finals MVP. He had Kevin Durant for the second and third championships. And that first Warriors team that won the championship, the Cavs are missing Kyrie and Kevin Love. So there are people who kind of want to asterisk Curry a little bit, even though he's a back-to-back MVP, once unanimous, the first unanimous in history, and has anchored three championship teams and finals team for five straight years. There are people, especially in the James Harden camp, who will say, but look at, because they need to fire back, right? The criticism of Harden is his postseason failures. So it's, yeah, well, he didn't have the benefit of all those players that Curry had. Let's see Curry do what Harden did and elevate his team every year, make him a playoff team by himself. That's what Steph is doing right now. And I know that the Warriors are on the fringe of the playoffs right now, but he's missed a bunch of games with injury. And if you look at the games he's played, they're 27-22. That's a 55% win rate. That would be 45 wins in a normal year. And this year would translate to being solidly in seventh place where the Mavericks are right now. Like, and that's with, I think, pretty lackluster talent around him, to say the least. Like, who's their second best player right now? An aging Draymond, who's 3 years removed from the All-Star game. You know, James Wiseman was a 19-year-old rookie center who needed a lot of work and couldn't even make it through the season healthy. Andrew Wiggins, Kelly Oubre, like, Bazemore. Like, where's the talent on this team? Steph Curry is putting up MVP numbers at age 33 with a lot of miles on him. Like, he's been incredible. He's still one of the most fun players to watch in the entire league, and he's showing that, yes, he can carry a lackluster roster if necessary.
I want to play a little game here with you because you bring up the point of James Harden. There's going to be that constant comparison about what Harden did versus what Curry does. Do you think that this Warriors team is worse as a team than anyone that James Harden played on? And I'm not going to ask you, I'm just sort of throwing this at you right now, so I'm not going to hold you to knowing every team that Harden played on, but I want to read you a couple of teams that Harden played on early in his time with Houston. There was the 2012-13 Rockets that won 45 games, made the playoffs. That team was led by Harden. The second leading scorer that year was Chandler Parsons, who had 15.5 points per game. That was Jeremy Lin's year in Houston. The legendary Omer Asik was on the list of top scorers in that team. Patrick Patterson was on that team. The immortal Carlos Delfino was scoring points on that team. That's one of them. That's a 45-win team. 13-14, that team looked a lot similar, but it had Dwight Howard on that mix. I guess you can say Dwight is, you know, makes the difference there with that group. After that, a 56-win team in 14-15. 500 team in 15-16. That was the team Harden played with Trevor Ariza. Dwight played on the team. I guess you're going to have to kind of look at that 12-13 season, Howard, where I mentioned the Parsons and Lynn and your favorite players, Omer Asik and Carlos Delfino. I mean, that's not...
I didn't know that Carlos Delfino was still in the league.
That's
then?
What I'm like, talking
I,
about.
I can't remember the last time I've ever heard his name.
Okay, he's him and Luis Scola just playing forever. That's not a great team.
That's impressive. No. You're right. That is the definition of lackluster, and that's an impressive feat. Could prime Steph Curry, because we're now comparing like James Harden at 23 or whatever to, you know, Curry of at age 30.
Although that wasn't that wasn't prime James Harden. Like, that was pre-prime James Harden.
Well, no. Prime in terms of he's still young and healthy and can carry a huge load.
Right.
Right? That's what I'm saying. We didn't know that Harden even had that in him when he got there, right? He had been sixth man in Oklahoma. Like, nobody
we knew he was really good, but, you know, was he great is the question.
Yeah, but nobody knew that. No, nobody knew he'd be this. Could prime Curry, whatever year you want to pick out of his best year, could he have done it with that team? If it's structured around him with the kind of system that works for him, like, maybe. I don't know that he couldn't have. He's built differently than Harden in terms of physically, clearly, the way he gets his points, the kind of system that best befits him. And if you put him into a Harden system where it's just run a ton of pick and roll and or just leave the ball in his hands and make him create and have a massively high usage rate, I don't know. I don't know if that's the best use of Curry anyway, and it might wear him down. Harden is more physically just stout, right? So I don't know. But I would say this, Chris. Over his last several years, which are the years that Harden gets criticized for, he had Chris Paul for 2 years. He had Russell Westbrook for a year. He had Dwight, for better or worse, for part of that. So let's not pretend that, like, those aren't players that, you know, if you plugged them into, if you could time travel and put those players on the Warriors now, like, Chris Paul would be better than anybody else the Warriors have. Dwight Howard would be the best big the Warriors have. You know, Russell Westbrook would be the best player the Warriors have. So, like, you know, let's look at the full expanse.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, if I'm going to say I learned anything about Steph, it's that I think his career could have more longevity than I thought it originally did. I mean, Steph, you know, because of his kind of his frame, I often wondered if his body would hold up, you know, beyond age 33, 34. But here he is, age 33, having an MVP caliber season. And oftentimes, Howard, and we've discussed this before, shooting is not a perishable skill. If you have it, you're probably going to have it throughout the course of your career. And Steph is showing that at age 33, he can play like this. I see no reason to believe why he can't do this through like 34, 35, 36. Maybe not MVP level, but certainly all-star level. And if he can do that, that just widens the window, I think, for Golden State, where initially maybe you thought it was 2 years. Now it might be three or four with this group, provided they fill in some of the blanks with guys that complement Curry and Clay and even Draymond with that group. So that to me is the biggest takeaway from Steph's run this year, that I think he can be a high-level guy for several more years to come.
Well, there's clarity now, right? Like, he's eligible for a massive extension this summer, and if in his
funny how that
year,
works. Funny how that works. So, you know, guys just play out of their minds in these extension years.
I think he would have anyway.
Probably.
He's a competitor. That's the other thing that we have seen underscored, right? Like, dude loves to play. Loves to play at a high level, loves these moments that he's having. I mean, and that's, again, like, it's just so much fun watching him. But the clarity for the Warriors is, you know, if on a year like this, with this roster, if Steph couldn't do what he's doing, you might think twice about an extension. You might think twice about how you're planning the next couple of years as you reincorporate Clay. And, geez, do we really have a championship window? Like, this is proof that you do. If Steph were, like, dragging at 22 points a game at a lower efficiency and the Warriors are 10 games out of the playoffs, I think now you're starting to think, well, how much do we want to invest in him in an extension? He's really important to the franchise, but are we making a mistake locking ourselves up into a guy who might be in decline? And do we really have a championship window? Well, now all that stuff is answered. Yeah, you have a championship window. If Clay's still himself, you still got the best backcourt and the best shooting backcourt in history. And yes, max out Steph again, patch it up around him, and go.
Yeah. I mean, that's got to be the mindset of Bob Myers and that front office. All right, Howard, I want to run through a few of these Twitter questions before we go. John Steichen, forgive me if I'm mispronouncing your name. When you see the makeup of the Olympic team being, what do you see the makeup of the Olympic team being? Last chance for some vets, second, third year guys. Does anyone even care? Feelings about another country getting gold. I have no idea, Howard, what the makeup of the Olympic team is going to be. A lot of that's going to depend on who's playing in the finals this year, you know, who's healthy at the end of the postseason, who wants to play. I mean, these guys have gone through what we now clearly know is a physically taxing year. I'm not so sure there's going to be a lot of people running to go to Tokyo to compete in the Olympics. I guess my question with the Olympics, Howard, is like the state of USA basketball. I mean, Jerry Colangelo is exiting after this cycle. Colangelo took over back in, 2005, when USA basketball was at its lowest point. They had just come in, I think, third in Athens in 2004. Before then, they were, the 0-2 debacle in Indianapolis, where they finished in, sixth place and looked completely out of sorts. The team rebounded and, won gold in 08 and 12 and 16 and looked like world beaters. But then you had what happened in 2018, where they finished, in seventh place in those world championships. And now you have another Olympic cycle where if you don't get the best players, pretty good chance you're going to finish outside of medal contention. And so I applaud, USA Basketball and Jerry Colangelo for getting this team back to where they were. I'm just not sure where they are right now. Do you think the Olympics are still cool for guys? Do they still want to compete? Or are we back where we were in, 2004, where you had 92, 96, and 2000, where everybody wanted to play? And then after that, it was maybe not.
No, listen, I don't think the luster is off. I think the luster may be off for this cycle only because, this was postponed from last summer and it's still being played amid a pandemic. Granted, everybody will be vaccinated by then, but it's so close to the season. It's just at a weird time. And I think that guys are going to think twice about this one. I don't think overall being part of Team USA and being part of the Olympics has lost anything. In fact, the more globally networked we all are, the better it is for guys' brands. It's a great opportunity not only to represent your country and the glory of winning gold and on a different kind of stage, but the experience of it and, yes, the chance to extend your brand and be in other markets. It's still got great allure for guys. However, this year is tough. I'm looking at some of the top candidates, Chris, and I saw somebody else had put together when they announced the 57 people who were in the pool, and they listed the guards. Point guards could be Steph Curry, Dame Lillard, Kemba Walker. And I'm looking at him thinking, Steph, after the miles he's putting on himself or the workload this season, I don't know that Steph, is he really going to want to be in this? I mean, if they make the playoffs, they're out early, so he's got time to recover. But is this a year for Steph to go? Dame Lillard, kind of the same thing. He's had a lot of heavy lifting this year. Shooting guards, Harden, Bradley Beal. All right, Beal will have had a nice long break as per usual. Harden might be in the finals. Is he going to want to turn around and go straight to Tokyo? Klay Thompson's in the shooting guard pool. He's not going to be playing. Kawhi Leonard, again, a guy who could be in the finals or at least the conference finals, depending on whether the Clippers have a flameout again. Is he going to go? Paul George is in that pool, I think. Is he going to go? LeBron James. LeBron's, had this injury-marred year. And he could be in the finals. So, depending on who gets the deep run, Anthony Davis, same thing, of course. There's just a lot of guys who, if they're playing in June, July, I just can't see them necessarily turning around after the short turnaround from last season, everything they've been through, injuries. Who knows what that final roster is going to look like? I suspect it may not be as glitzy as usual.
I want to see LeBron, win a championship as an 8 seed and then turn around in mid-July, hop on a flight to Tokyo and win a gold medal.
I want to see him win as the 10th seed play-in team,
fine.
And then do it.
And then do it. Like, that's just the ultimate bleep you. You want to keep calling me, you know, not the greatest of all time. I just won another gold medal with USA basketball, and I did it like, you know, after a week off from playing a grueling NBA season. I do think LeBron will be one of the most interesting guys. I think in his heart he wants to play, but physically that just may not be possible for a guy going through what he's been going through to make that happen. Andre asks, now that Kobe will be inducted to the Hall of Fame, what do you think about Kobe becoming the NBA logo? Many players are pushing for it to happen. Would it be disrespectful to Jerry West or just a fair tribute to one of the GOATs? Howard, this is your favorite topic, the changing of the logo. Kyrie Irving initially pushed Kobe as the logo. The NBA has said it's not going anywhere. It's not going anywhere, nor should it go anywhere. I would encourage you, Andre, to listen to a previous podcast that we did. We discussed this in depth, but I assume, Howard, you are not on board with Kobe Bryant logo.
No, I mean, the quick hit bullet points, if nothing else. It doesn't need to be anyone. Yes, it was modeled after Jerry West, but it doesn't. No one looks at it and says, oh, there's the Jerry West NBA logo. I mean, older crowd might, but it's not supposed to be anybody. It's supposed to be a generic basketball player. Now, if you want to restyle the logo to make it more eye-popping, more encapsulating today's athleticism of somebody dunking or something, that's fine. But, you know, we could say, oh, well, if that's the case, it should be Kobe or it should be MJ. It should be whoever. The NBA is not going to do that. I guarantee you that if they ever redesign the logo, they will never say that it's based on any one player. It'll be representative of their game and their league. You don't want it to be based on one guy. It's supposed to represent the league. This is the only sport, the only league where we do this, where we say that the logo should be this guy. But, you know, look, if you're going to base it on a guy, why wouldn't it be MJ or Magic or Kareem or Russell. Bill Russell? Yeah. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. And I get the push, especially in the wake of Kobe's passing last year. There's a sentimentality to this, and he's a beloved figure. And like it sounds right as a gut instinct. It feels right. But when you start to think about it, it really doesn't make much sense.
Yeah, not going to happen. All right, last question. With Brad Stevens reportedly shunning Indiana's massive offer, what would it take for an NBA coach to jump ship to college? This is coming from Ryan. This is on the heels of Woj kind of casually dropping on TV that Indiana was prepared to offer Brad Stevens a 7-year, $70 million contract to become the head coach. Brad ultimately turned them down. Howard, I've been on record saying you're just not going to get a successful NBA coach to go back to college. The lifestyles are just so different. Even at the highest of levels, whether it's Mike Krzyzewski at Duke, Roy Williams and now Hubert Davis at North Carolina, Bill Self at Kansas, you just lead a better life as an NBA coach. You just have to coach. You get all the perks that come with being basically an NBA player. You get the same hotel rooms. You're not staying at, you know, Motel 6 while they're at the Ritz. You get the exact same setup that they do. Private jets, all that stuff. And you don't have to recruit. That's the biggest thing. You do not have to spend hours on end every day, 12 months a year, recruiting guys. And that sucks. You know, coaches do not want to go back to recruiting players. So it would need to be something truly special for a successful NBA coach to go back to the college ranks.
Yeah, I mean, look, maybe it's sentiment. Maybe it's your alma mater that you want to go back to coach, right? Maybe you are just blown away. Maybe somebody does make you a $10 million a year offer. And most coaches in the NBA, I don't know what the current average is, what, like $5, $6 million for NBA head coaches? Do you know the figure right now?
It's roughly that. Some teams are cheap. Like, yeah. You know, and look, Brad Stevens, I think, is in the $6 to $8 million per year range. So it would have been, I believe, a pay increase. But again, you know, you just have to go back to that life. Like, if you're Brad Stevens, you got to know, too, like, that kind of offer is probably always going to be there. Like, it's not like you can, you know, Indiana 3 years from now, you know, when Mike Woodson doesn't work there, because I don't know, that doesn't make any sense to me. But, like, that offer could potentially be there. You don't jump on that right now. But, I agree with you. It takes something special for that to happen.
Yeah, something unusual, some other tie to the university. And maybe, you know what? it may well be that somebody does blow you away and that you could get paid more there. Like, Brad Stevens is a different kind of example, but like there are coaches, you know, maybe who aren't paid quite as well at the NBA level. Right?
Alex Jensen just turned down Utah. Like, that's an assistant coach with the Utah Jazz turned down a head coaching opportunity with the University of Utah. Like, what are we, like, this is an assistant coach who also gets all the perks of being an NBA player.
Recruiting, you're going into these guys' homes, you're working your butt off, begging and pleading and schmoozing and selling and everything, just so they can either turn you down or come in and then leave a year later. You know, like, yeah, NBA free agency is a pain in the butt, but it's not one and done for the most part. So, yeah, it's a better life in the NBA if you can get one of those jobs. There are fewer of them. There's only 30. But if you get one and you can stay in that circulation, right, you get fired a couple times, you know, the average, you know, NBA coach, you know, you're going to get two or three cracks at it, right, if you're decent. I'd rather do that than have to worry about academic rules and NCAA nonsense and all this. No, I don't see too many NBA coaches, jumping to make the move to college.
Oh, Mike Woodson is like the perfect coach to do that. Like, Woodson probably does not have a great chance of landing another head coaching job. Indiana was his alma mater. I completely understand why Mike Woodson would jump and take maybe his last head coaching opportunity. I don't have any idea why Indiana would want to do it. Like, I'm not sure how that's going to work. Like, I respect Mike Woodson's basketball acumen, but, you know, I mean, he's going to have to assemble the most crack staff ever to help him adjust to life in the college ranks. So that part of it I don't really get. But for Mike Woodson, go do it, man. Get your check and, you know, cash in. So
Yeah. And that's it. I don't see the allure otherwise.
No, me neither. Howard, good stuff, man. Do you have another podcast this week? Are we doing two this week?
We're doing two. Yes. So for the folks who have not caught on yet or didn't see it in their feed, we've got two a week now. Fridays, it's me with a guest. We had tag team last week. Again, two guys this week. They have something in common. Has to do with both their profession and their fandom. The team, I'll just say they're fans of the Knicks. I won't reveal the names yet, but keep an eye out for that coming on Friday.
All right. Check it out. Twice a week, Crossover Podcast. Howard, we'll do this again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.